the need to get buy-in from the organizational thought leaders. I learned I needed to have people who knew how the business ran involved during the design phase. Just because something made sense to him didn't mean it would make sense to the people who had to carry it out. Whether you're motivating your team to take the hill, bringing a new product to market, or winning over a prickly board of directors, perspective getting can make the difference between success and failure. Typically, every CEO candidate we meet is good at relating to others in some domains, but few have mastered all of them. We might see someone who's listening closely to the customer, but is anxious dealing with board members. Someone else might be perfectly in sync with her direct reports, but jarringly out of tune when it comes to peers. At every level of our careers, we are part of a web, and each of us benefits from developing connections across that web, asking enough questions and listening closely enough to develop strong perspective-getting muscles. A surprising tool for perspective-getting. The importance of finding powerful and supportive mentors is among the mainstays of your typical Career Management 101 instruction. However, when we had SAS crunch our assessment data, we found that the weaker CEO candidates talked about the importance of mentors to their careers. The stronger candidates talked about offering mentorship to others more than about the mentorship they received themselves. While completely contrary to conventional wisdom, this is consistent with everything we know about engaging for impact. Mentoring others is a powerful laboratory for perspective getting. It's hard to help someone without understanding his needs. Those who mentor others become the men and women who have the team, the network, and the resources to get things done. Growing as a leader is a lot easier when there are people eager to follow you. And corporate boards know that when they hire a CEO, they hire her network too. Jim Donald summed up his success across his CEO roles at Starbucks, Pathmark, and Extended Stay Hotels this way. The secret of rising in your career is taking care of everybody in the organization first, by giving people credit when they do it correctly, and then by forming relationships on the front line. That's so critical because as you climb, it's easier to have a base of support underneath you that pushes you up rather than trying to pull yourself up as an individual. Build your relationships through routines. Much of an orchestra conductor's job is done during rehearsals, well before the musicians get on stage. Similarly, for a leader, aligning effectively across an entire organization requires more than mere intention, more than a mere understanding of stakeholders' motivations and needs. It requires everyday habits and routines to build those relationships and to translate relationships into actions that advance business results. In fact, it requires rising stars and CEOs alike to adopt the very same deliberative practice that makes an orchestra great. Set routines and methods repeated day in and day out ultimately make the complex act of prompting an orchestra of diverse musicians to play in concert seem effortless and invisible. What follows are the four critical routines for achieving that level of performance mastery in how you engage for impact. 1. Communicate, communicate, communicate. Repetition matters. At Billabong, Neil Fiske created a 5-year, 7-stage turnaround strategy. He made sure people always knew where they were in the strategy and whether they were ahead or behind. Every conference call we have, every internal meeting, we come back to that in some way, shape, or form. How do you make sure your message gets through? Neil suggests what he calls the rule of sevens. Any message has to be repeated 7 times in 7 different ways before an organization has any hope of hearing it. Formal memo, videotape, a blog, posting a printed memo on the bulletin board, a town hall meeting, parking lot talk as you're walking, chat around the water cooler. You've got to push. You can't over-communicate. Without this constant push, messages simply don't land with enough consistency to engage everyone, as Steve Kaufman found at Arrow Electronics to his great frustration. When Steve visited local offices, he'd spend the first half of the day going through the office, talking to the operations people, and sitting with the general manager. Then in the afternoon, he'd go out and ride with the sales reps. "Hey, you know, what do you think of the marketing program with Texas Instruments? Is it working or not?" he might ask. A third of the time, the rep might say, "It's a great program. It's working. I'm getting a lot of sales." A third of the time, the person would say, "You know, it doesn't work here, and we've just adjusted it because our market is different." "And I can live with that," says Steve. The real trouble are the last third who'd say, "What program?" 2. Break down the sound barrier. Most executives we work with severely underestimate the sound barrier around their office. In their minds, they are still Mary or Randy, one of the team. Whereas for others in the organization, they became the big boss the moment they got promoted. It takes extra effort to continue unfettered communication. CEOs must proactively take steps so that people feel comfortable opening up and sharing critical information, whether it be early warning indicators, opportunities to improve, or even great wins. Robert Hansen, the current CEO of John Hardy, used this tactic earlier in his career to turn around the decline of Levi's Europe when he was the brand's president. At the time, the general manager in each European country was running his or her own fiefdom. This created expensive inefficiency and a Levi's 501 product that varied significantly from country to country, a problem for an iconic look. The general managers were decades older than the then young and inexperienced Hansen, and they were wary of giving up their autonomy. Calling them to his office would have been seen as an immediate power play. Instead, he showed them the respect of a personal visit to build common ground. By showing respect and learning their needs, Hansen got them on board with the changes. By the time he left Levi's, revenue was growing again, reversing a double-digit decline. 3. Marry corporate, date the field. A concept in Kaizen methodology suggests managers go to where work is done. Effective CEOs get out of their office to meet their teams in their own comfort zones, where the work is being done. Some of the best CEOs, for example, Jim Donald, the former CEO of Extended Stay Hotels, Starbucks, and Pathmark, have told us they spend up to half of their time out of the office and in the field. Think about that. Half of Jim Donald's week was spent with receptionists, housekeepers, and guests, far afield of the image of the jet-setting tycoon-greeting CEO. From his former boss, Sam Walton, the founder of Walmart, Jim had learned early that leaders belong out on the floor, ever persistent in their quest to learn from customers and employees, and in turn, improve. When it came to management, Jim used email to create a powerful feedback loop. At Extended Stay, he sent 2 handwritten letters, which were then scanned and emailed, to hundreds of district and regional managers every week. The letters closed with a call to action. "Please email me." Every week he got flooded with responses, and every week he answered every single email. Property managers for the company received a daily voicemail from their CEO. The time invested paid off. Jim frequently heard about issues even before his executives did. We often see talented professionals flatline mid-career because they fall too far to either extreme on the engage for impact bell curve. Some drive toward results with urgency, but leave behind a trail of broken glass. Others are so concerned about how everyone feels that they struggle to move the business forward. In both cases, it can be daunting and even unnatural to shift the approach. As Jim told us, "It's not glamorous, it's not sexy, it's not fancy suits, You have to actually roll your sleeves up and put on the company shirt and go get your hands dirty. Engaging for impact is the deliberate application of intent, perspective getting, and broad and consistent outreach carefully tuned to the climate of the organization and its people. It's actively probing and assessing what matters to whom and why. Eventually, this muscle building develops into what feels like natural instinct, enabling you to engage with everyone from a marketing intern to an engineering executive without the need for specialized expertise. The path to CEO is an endless education in human nature. Those who rise from the pack are, quite simply, the most devoted students. Test your ability to engage for impact. Whether you are managing others for the first time or are already well along in your career, we challenge you to assess whether or not you've fallen into the niceness trap. Rate yourself using the questions that follow. Get feedback from trusted colleagues. If you have answered yes to more than three questions that follow, you may be falling into the niceness trap. You may find that changing your behavior will pay outsized dividends in business performance. 1. Do your teams feel that your organization has too many priorities? 2. Do people leave performance review meetings you conduct with them unable to clearly articulate their strengths, gaps, and what's expected of them? 3. Do you move slowly to determine how to handle a loyal team member who is unlikely to fit with the company's future? 4. Is the word nice in the top three adjectives used to describe you? 5. When considering a decision, is your first thought about how it will impact relationships? 6. Do those around you, your team, your boss, say you avoid or minimize conflict? Key takeaways. 1. Define your intent. Align your aspirational intent, your most important big picture goals, with your transactional intent, your goal for any one interaction. 2. Deploy perspective getting to understand various stakeholders. 3. Build routines to enlist stakeholders behind your intent. Chapter 4. Relentless reliability. Deliver consistently. We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. Aristotle. One of our most surprising discoveries concerned an attribute considered so mundane, it's generally ignored. In fact, you'll never see it celebrated in CEO profiles or the business press. And yet, of all the behaviors that lead to executive success, it is the only one that both increases a candidate's odds of getting hired and his or her odds of excelling in the job. What is the quality? It's not confidence or experience or even decisiveness. The killer behavior behind both hiring and performance success is reliability. CEOs who are known for being reliable are 15 times more likely to be high-performing, and their odds of getting hired are double those of everyone else. While reliability sounds obvious, we see leaders struggle every day trying to get themselves and their organizations to consistently execute on their commitments. A case in point, over 9,000 leaders have taken our diagnostic on the CEO genome behaviors, and reliability continues to score the lowest. Why? Often leaders rising up through the ranks in large companies are reliant on management systems that already exist. They are users of reliable systems, but haven't had to build them. When faced with a situation where reliable systems and processes are lacking, they struggle. For leaders who have come up through the ranks in small companies, too often the experience is all hands on deck all the time, addressing crushing problems and putting out fires. The executives fighting those fires feel that they are accomplishing a lot, and they are. But in the heat of constant firefighting, little attention is spent on putting processes in place to prevent the next fire. When they are thrust into CEO roles with high expectations, immense pressure, and short timelines, it is very difficult for them to make the case to invest time and money to build a strong business management system. Why is reliability so powerful? Leaders who are reliable create the assumption among their customers, board members, and staff that they will get things done. Boards love a safe pair of hands, so do fellow senior executives. And the data suggests that these candidates go on to create high-performance organizations. Take Bill Amelio. He's a veteran three-time CEO and currently the CEO of electronics distributor Avnet. Bill is high-energy, decisive, always pushing forward. He is an activity junkie who cannot sit still. There's nothing he loves more than winning, and nothing he hates more than losing. He is the sort of person who almost never fails to keep a commitment. As his high school wrestling team learned, when he competed through an entire wrestling season while recovering from a dislocated elbow, he ended up placing a close second in a tough Pennsylvania State finals match, losing the championship 6-4. As a CEO, Bill exudes reliability. Everything about his MO says to those around him, "We're going to get this done." In each of his five executive roles since the late 90s, Bill established a calendar of communications, from weekly team meetings to quarterly town halls, and didn't deviate from that. In the words of one of Bill's direct reports, "You can't help but get the sense with the cadence of meetings that there is a strong management discipline. Bill has a systematic approach for succinct meetings, takeaways, accountabilities, and a sense for the rhythm of how the organization is run. Everyone knows exactly what's expected and is held accountable to it." When we first met Bill Amelio, he had recently become the CEO of CHC Helicopter. CHC operates the largest fleet of medium to large helicopters in the world. Their metal birds transport oil rig workers offshore and fly search and rescue and emergency medical missions from Nigeria to Azerbaijan to the North Sea. Lives depend on CHC delivering reliable performance. But while the company kept customers safe, it was doing so at great expense. The billion-dollar-plus global enterprise with 5,000 employees in 30 countries had been run like a mom-and-pop shop. The management team hadn't met its budgets in years. Helicopters sat idle. Getting spare parts was a mess. Bill was tasked with turning things around. A year into Bill's CEO tenure, CHC started meeting its budgets and beating them, despite severe market pressure and a large debt burden. When Bill takes the helm of an organization, he rebuilds like an engineer, creating business systems that find and address root problems. He redesigned the structure of CHC, making accountability a top priority. He wanted one person clearly accountable for each and every business priority. He quickly upgraded the management team, bringing on board a world-class CFO, head of operations, and other executives. With his executive team, he tracked action items relentlessly. The list had 347 items at its peak, which Bill thinned out to 35 as he led the team to more solid footing. As part of advising Bill, we conducted an annual 360 feedback process for him and his executive team. 21 feedback providers we interviewed for Bill were unanimous in reporting that his reliability was the key factor driving the company's success. They spoke admiringly of Bill's diabolical follow-through. After CHC, Bill went on to become CEO of electronics distributor Avnet. Here, too, he quickly implemented his playbook of building a strong team and a robust business management system. A hallmark of reliability is following through on commitments. In the sample we studied, 94% of the strongest CEO candidates followed through consistently on their commitments. Research in the field of organizational psychology has found that people who are organized, disciplined, and thorough, that is, people who score high in conscientiousness, one of the five basic personality dimensions, have an increased probability of success in management roles. Bill Amelio may be one of the toughest bosses you are likely to encounter, but tellingly, strong people follow him from company to company. The reason is simple. With Bill at the helm, they consistently win, and winning employees are engaged employees. Harvard Business School's Teresa Amabile, who studies the science of engagement, has found that nothing makes employees more satisfied and fulfilled and enthusiastic about their work than making progress. In business, reliable and competent people are cherished. Employers and clients are more apt to take risks on them and more apt to give them opportunities. They know instinctively that their determination to follow through is a huge factor in terms of career and company success. Moreover, being known for reliability gets you recognized. Mary Berner, today the CEO of Cumulus Media, told us that she got her first CEO gig at Fairchild Publications as the publisher of Glamour magazine because of her reputation for delivery without drama. The pillars of reliability are personal consistency, setting realistic expectations, practicing radical personal accountability, and embedding consistency into the organization. Discover the thrill of personal consistency. Boards and shareholders place great value on consistency of results. Consistency leads them to believe that they can count on continued strong performance in the future. For example, we recently advised a board on CEO succession that was considering two strong internal CEO candidates. Call them Peter and Mike. Peter often delivers way beyond his targets, pulling rabbits out of hats right and left. The trouble is that he's erratic. His wins look more like wild luck than repeatable behavior. There's a fine line between visionary thinking and harebrained schemes, and with Peter, the board isn't sure which they're getting. Then there's Mike. Mike, on the other hand, rarely exceeds expectations, but he always meets them. You could set a clock by his performance. He's consistent and as solid and reliable as a rock. The board feels that they can trust him to deliver year in, year out. Most boards, we find, choose a predictable performer over a mercurial genius. Life is full of surprises, but in their way of thinking, none should come from the CEO. Understandably so. In the boardroom, reliability consistently trumps exceptionalism as an individual character trait. The fact is, people can anticipate and control for consistent, if unusual, behavior. But managing or working for an inconsistent boss or partner is like trying to do good work while running through a minefield. Of the hundreds of 360 reviews we've conducted of underperforming CEOs, almost without exception, each one displayed destructive inconsistency in countless arenas. Here are a few archetypes that stuck out. The seagull. She is hands-off until she has a flight to catch that will take her away from the office for a few days. Suddenly you get a million emails and everything you've been doing for 3 months is wrong. The fireman. He waits to act until things become a crisis, and we don't know when or if or how he will step in. The dilettante. I never know what he'll dive into on any given day. Today it's China, tomorrow it's lean manufacturing, the next is how big data affects our business. His limited attention span whipsaws the organization, and we end up mastering nothing. The hothead. His reaction to anything depends on whether you catch him in a good mood or a bad mood. He has a new measuring stick to judge our work every day. None of us can figure out what puts him in a bad mood. Doug Shipman, the founder and former CEO of the Center for Civil and Human Rights and current president and CEO of the Woodruff Arts Center in Atlanta, said to us, "Being consistent creates clear expectations. You want your team to be able to anticipate the first and second questions you ask and have already thought through the answers. You are teaching what you want them to pay attention to. If the budget numbers come back out of whack, you want them to dig into the critical levers on their own. The moment you are inconsistent twice, there is a new pattern. Jeff Swartz, the former CEO of Timberland, echoed this sentiment. If you want to be serious, then you have to be serious all the time. Because if you're serious one day and happy the next, people will be confused. They won't be able to figure out where you're coming from, and that'll be threatening. Personal consistency creates a powerful, compelling rhythm that allows people to perform at their best. The habits of highly reliable leaders. The successful CEOs we meet who understand the critical importance of reliability know that the little stuff matters. They work hard at being reliable in everything they do. They are on time for meetings, for planes, for phone calls. They make individual commitments, who is taking what actions by when, clear in meetings. They follow up on agreed-upon actions religiously. They make lists, to do, to read, mistakes, people to keep in touch with, useful resources, etc., and put those lists into action. They are aware of their mood, words, and actions in their interactions with their teams. Are their actions and words having the desired effect? They keep the people who need to know in the loop so that no one drops the ball. Set realistic expectations. The belief that you are reliable, that you will do exactly what you say you're going to do, is the force that moves others to action. As Alyssa Villanueva Beard, the CEO of Teach for America, put it, everyone is watching a chessboard, and each move you make speaks about who you are as a person, your values, your expectations, and how you care about and steward the work. So how do you create the perception of reliability when you're in the early stages of your career and may not yet have a track record you can point to? Here's what we've learned from studying the best. They proactively shape their commitments to create a situation where they can reliably deliver. There are plenty of workers, from delivery men to desk jockeys, who do what they say they're going to do. The superstars who transform reliability into a core leadership trait take this a step further. Just the doing isn't enough. They actively shape expectations for themselves and their teams. They don't wait until their pay grade or their title gives them the authority. Jason Blessing, the CEO of the software company Plex Systems, told us that he owed his success on a global software implementation project, the most challenging project of my life, to his ability to seize and reset expectations. He was only 26 and working at PeopleSoft at the time. A senior partner was in way over her head on a $10 million global software implementation. People on the project were calling it a train wreck. Jason was asked to step into what was indeed a mess, initially working alongside the partner who was in over her head. While he brought strong project management skills, the real difference maker was how he reset expectations with his client. The expectation was to use PeopleSoft resources, but Jason saw that they had staffed the project all wrong. For the project to be successful long-term, they needed a different approach. He had to sell the client not just on taking the partner, his boss, off the project, a politically tricky move, but on staffing more of the project in-house instead of relying on consultants. In short, he needed to sell them on a new set of expectations on how to best accomplish the job. Jason and his team ultimately crushed their goals, and the success he achieved put him on the map throughout the company as the guy who delivers, and the doors to opportunity flew open. Reliable leaders look beyond the commitments that have been established explicitly. They watch carefully for signs of implicit expectations that are in play. Boards and bosses can often be spectacularly unclear in their communication. We recently saw a CEO trip up, even though he had not only met but even exceeded established revenue targets. His company, an internet security services firm with around $50 million in revenue, had been acquired by a mid-market private equity firm. Based on market conditions at the time of the acquisition, they set revenue targets. Now, the CEO was no slouch. He was working nonstop and had his team moving at a rapid clip. But busy as he wasn't staying abreast of his communication with the board, constantly taking their temperature, monitoring their feedback and comments for signs that the expectations they had made explicit had changed. As the year went on, the economic climate for the industry improved. The owners got excited, and although they didn't explicitly ask for it, they assumed they'd see a corresponding boost in revenue beyond their agreed-upon goals. When the CEO finally showed up to present the numbers, he thought they would be pleased with his performance. He'd hit all the targets. But the board was unimpressed. They wanted a lot more than he'd delivered. He felt blindsided, which caused frustration on his part and strained relationships with the board. Attempting to set expectations with your boss, or in the case of the CEO, the board, isn't about believing you have the right to set your own terms and agenda. It's having the skills to sense what others want, but may not say, as well as the ability to persuade them to see the future as you intend to shape it. Wherever you are in your career, you too can shape expectations to ensure reliable delivery. When you're handed a project, your response shouldn't be, "Okay, I'll get to work on it." Say instead, "Here's what I'm going to deliver by when, and consider it done." And then make sure you follow through. Stand up and be counted on. Getting others to move to your drumbeat requires more than clear expectations and relentless follow-up. You need to become a leader who makes his or her employees want to hit the target. There are two ways we've seen such exacting leaders as Bill Amelio buy themselves the latitude to be as tough as they are and still win the undying loyalty and reliability of their teams. CEOs who excel in reliability practice radical personal accountability with their stakeholders, employees, customers, clients, partners, and the board. They earn the right to hold others accountable by holding themselves accountable to the highest standards. Mary Berner, the delivery without drama CEO we mentioned earlier, told us how she held herself accountable to her team and her entire organization. At one of her tougher CEO gigs a few years after she joined, Mary steered Reader's Digest through a prearranged bankruptcy. Mary realized she needed to quickly embed a fresh 21st century notion of personal accountability and transparency while enacting some very tough decisions, such as cutting 8% of the workforce. So what did she do? She let every single one of her 5,000 employees grade her personally every 6 months, and she posted every comment without filter on the company intranet for everyone to see. "People thought that I would filter them, but they could tell by what was up there that I didn't. Because the good, bad, and ugly were all out there, it created credibility." What happens as a CEO is that you live in your own little world, and CEOs spew out a lot of rhetoric. Every CEO out there talks about accountability, but if you are not personally accountable to your people, they don't buy it. The second behavioral pattern we recognized was deeply rooted in the motivations of these high-rising leaders. Underneath the customary ambition and drive, we witnessed a core desire to be someone whom others can truly depend on. In their personal and professional lives, highly reliable CEOs want to stand up and be counted on. We saw this trait while interviewing Jason Blessing, the Plex Systems CEO we mentioned earlier. When he stepped into that early career-defining project we described earlier, professional ambition wasn't on his mind, and he wanted us to understand that. He wasn't jockeying for power or looking for renown. His drive was much simpler. He just wanted to help. I was trying to act with integrity to make our customers successful and the team successful, he told us. Earlier on in our work with CEOs, we would have naively told you that Blessing must be an outlier. What trait other than hard-driving ambition would cause someone to take on such a difficult project with such a low chance of success? Now, having interviewed hundreds of CEOs, we know that this motivation, the desire to be someone others can always count on, isn't an anomaly. In fact, it's a dominant theme. Bill Amelio may have said it most clearly. One of the best reasons to want to be CEO is that you really love managing and leading people. It's something that just turns you on. The fact is you care about others. The last time we saw Bill, he had just spent the better part of his weekend helping one of his executives navigate a family crisis. Leaders are there when it counts, said former USC professor and leadership guru Warren Bennis. They are ready to support their coworkers in the moments that matter. Early in our careers, we tend to be task-oriented. It is the desire to achieve individually that leads many of us to become high performers. For those of you who are young and hungry, words like dependable and steady may still feel foreign in a professional context. That's normal at this stage of life. Not many begin their careers with a natural focus on responsibility to others. But with experience over time, those who aspire to senior leadership develop in that direction. There is a simple reason. Those who don't focus outward find that their careers hit a brick wall. To become a successful manager and leader, you need to be able to transition from being focused on individual achievement to collective achievement. One scales and the other doesn't. Those focused primarily on themselves stop delivering when they begin managing others. The more senior you become, the more attention and energy you have to invest in your team. Those who move up start asking themselves, what are my boss, colleagues, clients trying to do, and how can I help them get there? Adopt the drills of highly reliable organizations. Our final insights on reliability come from some unlikely places. Nuclear reactors, aircraft carriers, and oil rigs, high-risk workplaces where reliability isn't a matter of meeting quarterly targets, but literally a matter of life and death. Every aspect of these organizations' culture and process has to be fine-tuned to minimize failure, ensure safety, and avert catastrophe. They're confronting head-on the challenge that we've heard hangs on a sign posted at the Navy's Top Gun Fighter Pilot Academy. Under pressure, you do not rise to the occasion. You sink to your level of training. Organizational psychologists call these high-reliability organizations. In comparing practices in them to the habits of reliable leaders in our own data, we saw parallels that can help people perform in complex, high-pressure systems, basically every modern corporation. Of course, bringing these practices to life will require some tailoring to your business, industry, objectives, and context. For companies in turnaround, for example, we've seen CEOs go so far as to personally sign off on every check, because successfully managing cash flow carries life or death implications. Yet this same tactic would amount to harmful micromanagement in a highly innovative business in growth mode. 1. Make mistakes safe. We've spoken before about the importance of learning from failure to fine-tune your decisiveness muscle. In high-risk environments, leaders recognize that a minor slip-up is a precious opportunity to prevent a future major catastrophe. Then they work to build better procedures. For this to work, of course, employees are encouraged to uncover those tiny slip-ups. The more mistakes are shared, the faster conditions improve. They create an environment in which employees willingly draw attention to mistakes instead of sweeping them under the rug. An estimated 440,000 hospital patients in the United States die annually because of preventable errors. That is, over 1,000 people every day. At the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, CHOP, CEO Madeline Bell hired Health Performance Improvement, a consulting firm founded by former nuclear plant managers and naval aviators, to train CHOP staff. When the consultants interviewed her staff, they spotted an immediate red flag. Employees reported that management had a punitive response to errors. A punitive culture is not one where employees rush to tell managers about mistakes. Leaders focused on increasing reliability need to destigmatize mistakes. At CHOP, the solution was a program to celebrate rather than criticize staff who reported near misses, for example, when a patient was about to receive the wrong medication. CHOP implemented a critical change in language as well. Today, near misses are called good catches. As CEO, Madeline meets everyone who has had a good catch on a monthly basis and sometimes meets them at the bedside. And the hospital also offers an annual Good Catch of the Year award. 3 years after Madeline's retraining effort, serious safety events had decreased by 80%. 2. Level the playing field. These leaders create the expectation that everyone, workers, managers, and leaders, are equally qualified for and responsible for calling out problems and identifying solutions. All employees are encouraged to raise issues, even when it means ignoring hierarchy. In a hospital's operating room, for example, lives are on the line. But this is also a place where a strong hierarchy is very natural. The surgeon is king, and a nurse is far down on the totem pole. Atul Gawande, a renowned surgeon, best-selling author, and health policy expert, set out to discover the most powerful ways to save lives and reduce suffering. Our colleague, Alan Foster, has been working with Atul as his leadership advisor for over 7 years. Atul has found that crushing the barriers of hierarchy is critical to reducing the number of patients who die on the operating table. Atul's colleagues trained surgical teams to introduce themselves to one another by name. It's a seemingly superficial icebreaker, yet Atul's team found that it instantly opened the channels of communication. It announces to each person on the team, "Your voice is unique and valued. You have a responsibility to speak up." This empowers the nurses and technicians with the confidence to tell the surgeon if they have doubts whether the doctor is operating on the correct leg. Similarly, great CEOs empower all their employees to raise their voices. And equally important, they make sure they stay close enough to the field to listen. CEOs often tell us that the ideas that move the needle didn't come from their senior team, but from the cashiers, the customer service reps, the drivers, and the button pushers. As Bill Amelio put it, "You just gotta get out there, kick the tires. Lo and behold, things always come out on the table that you hadn't known before. In general, people want to tell you the truth." Bill will respond to an email from anyone in the company within 24 hours. 3. Create a precise shared vocabulary. Leaders of reliable cultures recognize that successful execution requires seamless communication. They invest in creating a shared, precise vocabulary to speed up alignment and reduce the risk of mistakes. Our former GH Smart partner, David Works, knows a thing or two about precise language. He was an engineer at a semiconductor manufacturing plant at Motorola and was CHRO at Sears and Windstream after leaving GH Smart. He spent his early career in the Navy on a nuclear submarine, where reliability failure could easily cost lives. Precise language was drilled into the culture. Everyone on the sub knew that watch team backup meant that everyone was accountable for double and triple checking that a mission-critical process was followed correctly. Every time the quartermaster plotted a fix on the chart, David recounted, the officer of the deck double-checked it, every time. It is very much a part of the nuclear submarine force. I can remember that a friend of mine realized the critical chart was mislabeled as he was diligently rechecking. The submarine was at risk of being submerged in water they were not authorized for. This risks friendly collision, which is almost certain death on a submarine. Employing watch team backup resulted in a successful good catch. David carried this forward as the CHRO and then business unit president at Windstream. He realized that the organization needed to focus more on becoming operationally excellent and improving collaboration across functional areas. One step he took was developing a common language so that everyone understood what it meant to be accountable. One example was the concept, own it. David led a team to mutually define and adopt own it as committing to find a way to win instead of getting bogged down in finger-pointing. This specific shared vocabulary helped build a stronger execution-oriented culture, which contributed to improvement in customer satisfaction, Net Promoter Score or NPS, of roughly 20% in the installation of new services. How do you know that you have adequately embedded a shared vocabulary to ensure reliability? If you ask 50 people in your organization about the meaning of a particular term, everyone describes it the same way and acts consistently. Language is one of the ways a culture signals what is important. 4. Build the machinery of consistent process. Reliable leaders at all levels aren't just personally consistent, they build consistency into their organizations by engineering reliable processes. While outsized results are revered and celebrated, sometimes they are the result of Herculean efforts or market tailwinds that aren't sustainable in the long run. Inefficient and poorly designed work processes create ambiguity, confusion, and ultimately errors and failure. To sustain reliable results over time requires a thoughtful management system, complete with process, metrics, and a predictable cadence that architects for discipline. Of the strong CEO candidates we studied, 75% scored high on organization and planning skills. Will Powell, the CEO of Sears Hometown and Outlet Stores, learned this when he hired the wrong leader for one of his businesses. They got me a year of good results, but I could sense, underlying it, the head of the business, structurally, couldn't replicate it, he told us. He had flash and pizzazz to push ideas out there, but wasn't putting in place a foundation that was replicable. It started to unravel in year two, and I had to let him go. The magic comes from the fact that the system itself, the clear steps, deadlines, and measurable outcomes, makes it possible to hold people accountable for results. In our research, CEOs are almost twice as likely to be strong in holding people accountable than the average senior leader. Scorecard, simple reliability tool. One-way leaders at every level create personal accountability for themselves and each team member is by completing and sharing what we call a scorecard. Boards, CEOs, and senior executives and their teams use scorecards to make the implicit goals explicit and align around individual and collective accountabilities. This ensures all are clear about what they need to deliver. Scorecards can be used in the hiring process to articulate what success looks like in the role or as an ongoing alignment and performance management tool. A scorecard forces you to write explicit expectations on paper for each responsibility you have, asking you to define your mission and vision. A mission is a short statement of the immediate purpose of your work. A vision looks further out. What accomplishments and values will your company be known for in the future? Your top five priorities to accomplish them. What will move the needle and what needs to change so that your calendar going forward reflects those priorities? What would thrilling success look like for you and your organization 3 years out? What accomplishments would fulfill your vision? How do you quantify and measure those accomplishments? How will success be delivered? Simon Castellanos, CEO of Advanced Infusion Solutions, a leading provider of home infusion solutions, was one of many CEOs who told us that learning to build processes for consistency was one of the most important steps he took as an executive to prepare himself to be a CEO. Simon is yet another seemingly unlikely CEO. Simon immigrated to the United States from Ecuador in 1985 and started out his adult life in the United States walking 45 minutes to his carpenter's job in an abandoned building in Harlem so he could put the 90-cent bus fare he saved toward English classes. As soon as he learned the basics of English, he got a job as a late-night doorman that allowed him to attend college during the day. For the next 4 years, Simon worked all night and attended City University of New York full-time, graduating with a bachelor's degree in accounting. His first professional job was as a staff accountant at Parish Leasing, a small local company. It was his ability to reliably deliver that led him to be pulled into new, more challenging assignments. Bigger assignments led to bigger roles, bigger roles to bigger companies, and in 2014, 3 decades after he'd arrived nearly penniless in America, his improbable resume of success landed him the title of CEO of Western Dental, a $500 million company providing affordable dental care to underserved populations in the southwest of the United States. Earlier in his career, Simon arrived at Fresenius Medical Care as a vice president of operations and was soon promoted to president of the Central Business Unit, a $470 million dialysis services unit based in Chicago. Simon walked into a severely underperforming division that was failing at every quality metric. Staff turnover was well above industry benchmarks. The company was a revolving door, Simon told us, and the turnover was hurting their ability to deliver quality. He had to find a way to engage the staff. What he did first was to create a clockwork-like system of reporting on a weekly and even daily level. This included not only rear-view financial numbers for the prior time period, but also leading indicators that could show something might be going off the rails, such as patient satisfaction or clinic staff engagement levels. At first, people were reluctant and mistrustful. "We've had 3 or 4 guys in and out of the president position. Why should we take you seriously?" was their attitude. But Simon pushed forward. He implemented a consistent drumbeat of meetings and communications. He met with his team weekly to review reporting results across the regions, regions that fell below industry benchmarks on operating metrics or financials had to put remedial plans in place. Simon was personally on top of the metrics and on top of the team in a cadence of meet, measure, tweak, meet, measure, tweak. Employees' ideas were sought and good ideas were implemented. And over time, what was initially onerous and rote began to take on a different character. Consistency became momentum. It became commitment among the team and to Simon. After 2 years under Simon's leadership, the central division moved up from being the last to second of 5 business units on quality and became the most profitable division in the company. Employee turnover decreased from an abysmal 30% to the industry average of 19%. As Simon's team started to reliably deliver for customers and employees, the revenue decline turned into 3% annual growth in a market that was virtually stagnant. Simon credits the consistency of his actions with setting progress in motion. His team was crystal clear on what to expect and where to focus, and had a consistent process in place to ensure quality. Strong financial results followed. As we've discussed, reliable leaders build consistent practices personally, and they embed consistent routines into their organization. One counterargument we have heard from some executives is that in an era of uncertainty, process and routine can constrain an organization's ability to improvise and adapt. Not so, says Atul Gawande, the surgeon we introduced earlier. Atul's work has proven that the best way to help doctors and nurses manage the complexity and unpredictability of healthcare is to create a process in its simplest, most rote form, the checklist. In the book, The Checklist Manifesto, How to Get Things Right, he writes, "The fear people have about the idea of adherence to a protocol is rigidity or bureaucracy. They imagine mindless automatons heads down in a checklist, incapable of looking out their windshield and coping with the real world in front of them. What you find when a checklist is well made is exactly the opposite. The checklist gets the dumb stuff out of the way." In other words, by freeing ourselves of the cognitive burden of the dumb stuff, we can better take on the hard stuff, especially the relentless change that requires leaders to be nimble, capable of adjusting to surprises and functioning in disaster. Which brings us to the next chapter and our fourth and final core CEO genome behavior, adapt boldly. Assess your reliability. Ask yourself, how consistent was I this week in my interactions with customers, colleagues, senior management, and the people who work for me? When am I thrown off my game? It is situation specific. How do I manage those situations? Does everyone on my team understand what is expected of them? Do they own their results? Do they embrace responsibility and hold themselves accountable? What are my boss, colleagues, clients trying to do, and how can I help them get there? What expectations do my stakeholders have of me that aren't being openly discussed? What am I expected to deliver? Have I written it down? Have I shared it with my boss, peers, and team? How often was I on time for meetings in the last week? Key takeaways. 1. Operate with personal consistency. 2. Take a mindset of radical accountability. 3. Proactively shape expectations in the first weeks on the job and revisit as conditions change. 4. Build a business management system to drive repeatable results. Chapter 5. Adapt boldly. Ride the discomfort of the unknown. Most of the time I spend when I get up every morning is trying to figure out what is going to happen. Madeleine Albright. Kodak. Blockbuster. Borders. What do these names have in common? They were all once hugely successful companies that failed to adapt. The average lifespan of today's leading companies in the United States has decreased over the last century from 65 years to just 23 years, according to Richard Foster at Yale. To paraphrase H.G. Wells, adapt or perish now as ever is today's inexorable imperative. We spend most of our careers being rewarded and recognized for knowing more than do those around us. And yet every senior leader faces a turning point in her or his career when knowledge is no longer enough. It tends to coincide with the moment these leaders are given far more people to manage than they've managed previously, and when they are confronted with challenges that have no one right answer. Suddenly, or so it seems, they find themselves in uncharted waters beyond the boundaries of their competence. To get to the top, aspiring leaders have to learn to navigate the uncharted, and it is in these unknown waters that they, as senior leaders, will likely spend the rest of their career. What does it mean to be good at navigating the unknown? We asked